Welcome to On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on the program this week...
The 100% target that's been reached is just about electricity. Yeah. That's an area where Tasmania already had an advantage. We don't do any better than any other state in relation to other energy usage. So
Tasmania has always been heavily reliant on renewables for their energy, thanks to their investment in hydroelectricity. Now, a new wind generation facility located on the windy west coast of the island state promises to take them to the next level, to be the first state to have energy totally supplied from renewable sources within 2 years. Also coming up on The Money...
He is making it very clear that he expects this team to be, you know, they're not going to be there juggling, you know, monetary policy and having arcane discussions about, things on the margin. They are there to solve the big problems of the day and to do it very quickly.
President-elect Joe Biden has nominated ex-head of the US Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen, as his Treasury Secretary. Renowned writer and columnist Ann Summers is currently in the US, and we get her take on the likely economic direction under a Biden administration. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Money. New wine tariffs are just the latest development in the worsening relationship with China. This comes on the tail of the 14 grievances that China has levelled against Australia. Burton Hoon talks to some of the wine producers caught in the crossfire between Beijing and Canberra.
The Chinese government has announced recently that it will be imposing new tariffs on imported Australian wine. This revelation is the latest in souring tensions with our largest export market. These tariffs are set to range from 107 to more than 200%, which will be a huge blow to our wine industry. The move comes after China's Commerce Ministry gave informal instructions to importers to suspend orders of wine and six other types of Australian exports earlier this month. Bob Burton is the owner of Burton Vineyards, and I asked him about how he felt about the tariffs. Do you feel like the wine tariffs will affect your business?
Well, it certainly will. I mean, it's a significant market for us, so we're just waiting to see how it's going to impact. In reality, it's like the 200% tariff increase, in theory, is going to stop all sales. So I guess we're just, trying to work out what the solutions are, if there are any.
How much of your revenue or your business accounts for exports to China?
We're about 15%, so... And that's sort of pretty common for Australia. It's a very significant market.
So that 200% tariff, is that going to affect your bottom line a lot?
Well, the thing is that it'll probably affect it because the tariff is imposed. We sell on an FOB basis, and then we work with agents and importers in China. So what it'll do is it'll affect the retail price to the point where maybe it doesn't sell. So we have to wait to see what actually happens. I mean, if you can imagine, something tripling in price, which is effectively what we're talking about, then it's going to fundamentally change where it sits in the market. And that we don't know yet, but I presume that it's going to have a significant impact on sales, yes.
Are you looking into other markets in Asia, or what do you think the way forward is?
Well, if you listen to what the commentary on the news and social media is, it's quite simplistic because everybody sort of says, "Oh, we'll just go and find and sell it somewhere else." Well, we have been trying to expand markets somewhere else, but what we're talking about is. Almost 25 to 30% of our crop that we produce annually that will all of a sudden not be needed. So finding a market for that in this environment is not going to be easy.
Bruce Tyrrell from Tyrrell Wines thinks things may start looking up as we enter the holiday season. but is similarly wary with our trade relationship with China.
It'll steady everyone down in Australia. I think we're probably, as we come out of COVID, our domestic market's now starting to look like recovery, so that'll be an assistance.
What kind of impacts do you foresee the wine tariffs having on your business?
In China?
Yeah.
Well, obviously, it's going to have, as it sits at the moment, it pretty much has taken Australia out of the Chinese market to where one of the ones that's in the 221% tariff. So, you know, if our wine's on a wine list, the price will go up by about 400%. And obviously we'll no longer be competitive. So effectively, by the placing of that tariff, the Chinese government have made the Chinese market not viable for people like us in the Australian wine industry.
How much of your business is accounted for with trade with China?
Between about 8 and 10%.
Is that a significant portion, do you think?
Oh, look, it is still significant. It's very difficult to budget for China because orders come and go. But our gross profit in China is very high. So that's the bit we'll miss. It's not necessarily the dollar sales, but the profitability level.
What do you say to the Chinese allegations of dumping on the market?
Well, if for the last 4 years, the average price of Australian wine per litre going into the Chinese market has gone up by about 30%. So I'd suggest that proves quite the opposite of dumping. Unless there are companies that may be Chinese owned, and there's quite a bit. This is going to hurt a number of Chinese people, Chinese businesses that own wineries and or vineyards in Australia, unless they've been transfer pricing. But certainly the companies that were called out to answer to the dumping allegations, now three of those companies don't export to China, funnily enough. So I'm not quite sure why they were called out, but certainly the ones that answered that, you know, that there is no dumping case. That was something somebody made up in the middle of the night.
I spoke to Professor James Lawrenson, who is the director of the Australia-China Relations Institute at the University of Technology, Sydney, and I asked him who are the winners and losers in this situation.
There are no winners. There are no winners. Remember, trade, for example, is by definition a win-win transaction. You can't force someone to buy from you if you're a seller and vice versa. So if you stop trade, you're stopping a mutually beneficial exchange. So, for example, by China putting tariffs on Australian wine, clearly Australian winemakers lose. The Chinese market was worth $1.2 billion over the last 12 months. But at the same time, Chinese consumers lose as well. They want to buy Australian wine, and now they're being prevented from doing so. So it's all losers here. There's no winners.
Do you feel like we're heading in a negative direction, that you think things are going to get worse before they get better?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't see a bottom in sight. I think things are going to continue to get worse. We have a fundamental challenge here that is not being addressed, and that's this one. In 1996, Australia's Prime Minister John Howard told then Chinese President Jiang Zemin that they struck new terms. They struck terms for the bilateral relationship, and Howard told Jiang that he would never walk away from the United States alliance, but the alliance with the US would never be directed at China. Now, China now feels that Australia has betrayed those terms, that we do often weaponize the US alliance and direct it at China. And as far as I can see, until Scott Morrison and current Chinese President Xi Jinping can update that understanding, I think we're going to be in for some pretty choppy times ahead.
Director of the Australia-China Relations Institute, Professor James Lawrenson, ending that report with Burton Hun.
On the Money, hedge your bets and stay tuned.
the wild west coast of Tasmania, where the wind blows fairly constantly, a new 31-turbine wind farm at Granville Harbour near Zeehan will add to the island state's impressive hydroelectric wind generation. This will allow Tasmania to reach its target of 100% renewable energy in just 2 years. It's a remarkable comeback from the panic of a few years back when the mainland cable went out and Tasmania was facing blackouts. Sophia Tariq has the story.
Tasmania has reached its 100% renewable energy target 2 years earlier than planned. Jack Gilding, executive officer at the Tasmanian Renewable Energy Alliance, says that Tasmania has always been ahead of other states in renewable energy sources.
Well, we did start a bit close to the finish line in the sense that we've had hydroelectricity from last century. The last hydro station was actually built in the last century. A couple of wind farms were built in the last couple of decades. What's reached this particular milestone is two new wind farms. And the milestone is a bit of a calculation of how
You're
much
electricity
to
On the
we
Money
could
around Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers.
And that's understandable. It is an achievement, but you do need to understand the details of how it's calculated. So it's not because we're connected to Victoria and because we burn some gas and electricity goes backwards and forwards between Tasmania and Victoria, you can't just look at what happens in Tasmania. But it is a calculation of how much we would now expect to generate in a year versus how much we would expect to use.
80% of Tasmania's energy comes from hydrogen, which depends on high rainfall.
Hydro does vary a lot depending on rainfall, and that's been one of the arguments for Basslink, and also building wind farms and diversifying with the gas-fired power station, even though it doesn't run very often. So, yes, in a year where there's good rainfall, we would typically be exporting more to Victoria than we import, and in a low rainfall year, we might be importing more from Victoria. So that was a fairly traumatic experience a couple of years ago. What happened was that the Basslink cable broke at a time when the dam levels were quite low. So, I mean, when the dams are full, which doesn't really happen, but if they were full, we would have over a year's storage of electricity in storage. But it does vary seasonally, and the dam levels were quite low. And at that point, the Basslink cable broke, and it took them 6 months or more to fix it. So as a precaution, quite a lot of diesel generators were rented and set up around the place, a huge effort, but didn't actually end up generating a lot of electricity, but it did tide us over and provide some extra security. But that's obviously an extremely expensive and undesirable way of generating electricity in bulk.
And while problems with the Basslink, the cable which connects Tasmania to the national energy grid, has caused problems in the past, Jack Gilding thinks that they have learnt from their mistakes.
Well, I mean, it's very reliable. Anywhere in the national electricity market is highly reliable. And most of the issues are not about what they call unserved energy, not being able to generate as much electricity as people want. Most of the blackouts or blackouts that you have are caused by local issues in the transmission lines or the distribution lines rather than not having enough generation. Tasmania is very lucky to have that amount of storage, and so that allows us to feed in wind and solar when we've got them and use the hydro when we need to use the storage.
The achievement comes after the two newly instructed Granville Harbour and Wild Cattle Hill wind farms were connected to the energy grid.
So far there hasn't been a lot of opposition to wind farms in Tasmania. They are in relatively remote locations. Particularly with the state government talking about 200% targets, then that implies a lot more generation, and that generation will almost all be from wind. And so there are some concerns both about wind farm development in particular locations, wildlife-sensitive areas, and also the transmission lines that need to be built. I guess it's fair to say there's been little opposition to wind farms in Tasmania to date, but if we tried to very dramatically increase the amount of wind energy without proper controls on where they were built and how the power lines were routed and so forth, then there is likely to be more opposition.
Jack Gilding also says that while electricity prices have gone down due to the use of renewables, the Tasmanian energy sector is much different to other states.
I think it's generally accepted that the more renewable energy that's fed into the grid, the lower prices go. And that's because basically the renewables bid very low into a competitive market because they've got no fuel costs. So as a general rule, you would say that the more renewables you have, the more pressure downwards on price there is. It's a little bit more complicated in Tasmania because the government owns everything. It owns the generation, it owns the distribution, it controls through hydro the link to Victoria. So we've recently had a slight, about 2% reduction in retail electricity prices, but that's a decision made by the government and the economic regulator rather than the operation of the market. So, you know, I'd say that prices are stable or on the way down, and that renewables certainly contribute to that. But it's not a straight market in that sense, you know, because of the role of the government in just about every stage of the energy generation and distribution cycle.
The Tasmanian government has now set a new 200% renewable energy target for 2040.
So the 200% target that's just been legislated is for 2040. The problem with that, the two things about that. One is the legislation sets the targets and some reporting and has some technical exemptions from competition policy. It doesn't actually say how that extra generation will be encouraged or made to happen. And the other issue is that you don't actually need any more electricity than the Tasmanian demand unless you can export it to Victoria. We could export a little bit more electricity on the existing Basslink cable, but really the 200% target assumes that we've got what's called Project Marinus, which is two more cables connecting Tasmania to Victoria. And there's a really unresolved issue of who will pay for those because the beneficiaries are allegedly, you know, particularly Victoria, but also New South Wales, South Australia and a bit of Queensland, benefiting, but under the market rules as they are at the moment, Tasmanians and Victorians would pay 50% each, which, given there's very little benefit to Tasmanians from exporting extra electricity to the mainland, that's quite a controversial issue. So there is a legislated target, but it's not clear how it'll be met. And it's not clear that doing that's actually, you know, good for Tasmania. It might be a contribution to decarbonisation, renewable energy on the mainland, but there are other ways of doing that. So it's a bit of an open question.
Jack Gilving, Executive Officer at the Tasmanian Renewable Energy Alliance, ending that report from Sufia Tariq. No,
doesn't make sense to me. If your dollars don't make sense, listen to On the Money.
President-elect Joe Biden is getting his team together ready to take over from the crumbling Trump administration. Key appointment is Treasury Secretary and former head of the Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen, has been nominated to the acclamation of both sides of politics. Tina Quinn sat down with Anne Summers, writer, feminist, journalist and advisor to Prime Minister Bob Hawke, who is currently in the US, to find out how the impact will be of the former head of the Fed taking over as part of the Biden administration.
Finally, there will be competent leadership when it comes to managing the coronavirus, which, as you know, is completely out of control in this country, and the economy, which is also pretty much in free fall.
It seems extraordinary that you have to wait 2 months for that transition of power to take place. It's, you know, very different to what we have here in Australia. You've mentioned obviously the fantastic team that Biden is assembling. Now, I'd love to go through some of these appointments with you. The future is indeed looking very female. He has announced he will nominate Janet Yellen as his new Secretary of the Treasury, and she would be the first female to hold the position. First of all, how do you think this role is going? How important do you think this role is going to be during this administration, given the economic situation, as you've just referenced?
Oh, critical. Absolutely critical. I mean, it used to be said that the four top jobs in the US government were, you know, Treasury, Justice, Defense, and State. So, diplomacy, defense, the administration of justice, and the management of the economy. That's, you know, possibly expanded now to include Homeland Security. But, I mean, certainly the Treasury is one of, always has been, and now I think will assume even greater significance. And there's no doubt that the way in which Biden has, when he made the announcements in Delaware yesterday, and he gave a very interesting speech, and he started off by saying, when it comes to the economic ravaging that has occurred in the United States, help is on its way. Help is on the way, he said, and he as he announced this team. And I thought it was very interesting that he framed the announcement of Janet Yellen and the rest of the team in terms of the way in which he expects them to respond to the coronavirus and the economy. And he's framing the coronavirus response as being as much an economic issue as it is a public health issue, and he'll be approaching it on those two fronts. So, you know, given the extreme severity of the coronavirus and the fact that it's getting, you know, we've had the head of the CDC today saying the next 3 months in America are going to be the worst in the country's history when it comes to public health, and he expects there'll be 450,000 deaths by the time that Biden is sworn in. So, I mean, the scale of the catastrophe that's facing Biden, can't be exaggerated. It is just worse and terrible. And so he is making it very clear that he expects this team to be, you know, they're not going to be there juggling, you know, monetary policy and having arcane discussions about, things on the margin. They are there to solve the big problems of the day and to do it very quickly.
Yeah, so it sounds to me like it will be a two-pronged approach, and that the two will go very much hand in hand together, which is incredibly important in this time.
Well, actually, it's a four-pronged approach. I mean, they're the two. He has four priorities. They're the top two. The other two are racial justice and climate change. So, I mean, that the four things really are integrated, and I expect the economic approach that Biden will want Yellen and her team to unfold will be one that takes into account those four major catastrophes, if you like, of American life at the moment, and none can be solved without the other.
Janet Yellen's resume is incredibly impressive. She was a Federal Reserve Board governor. She worked as a top economic advisor during the second term of the Clinton White House, and was nominated by President Obama as Federal Reserve Chair, the first female to hold this position as well. So her approach to the economy is strongly rooted in Keynesian economics. So based on her history, do you think her approach to handling the current recession will be one of interventionism?
Well, as I just said, I mean, the framework in which Biden is outlining is one in which the economy and the coronavirus are sort of integrally linked, and the approach that will be taken, you know, one has to be dealt with in terms of the other. So, I mean, that suggests intervention of one kind or another, but exactly what shape that's going to take. I think the other thing to remember about Biden is that he was vice president when Obama took over in 2009 at the time of the last great recession, or what in Australia we call the GFC. Here they call it the Great Recession, where the unemployment then was actually worse than it is at the moment in the United States. And Biden, has very strong memories, I think, of how bad that situation was and what they had to do to turn it around. And, you know, the components of it were different, and what they were looking at there then were the banks and the auto industries, and it's different now. But the same kind of urgency is going to inform him, and the same kind of the need to take big, bold steps to shift whole sectors of the economy as required is something that I think that not only will he won't shy away from, but I mean, some of the team that he has put together are people who were there for that period in the Obama administration, quite a few of whom, you know, are on the record as saying that they felt that Obama was too timid and that they hope that Biden might be a little braver. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if that turns out to be the case.
Ann Summers, writer, feminist journalist, speaking there from the United States with Tina Quinn. And that's it for us on the Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business and the economy. Thanks to our producers, Burton Hun, Sufia Tariq and Tina Quinn. On the Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find all of our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. Subscribe to our podcasts, follow us on Twitter, look for at onthemoney2ser, and also find us on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Roderick Chambers. We'll be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Do stay well, and thanks for your company. Well, baby used to stay out all night.